do want to address the tragedy of what happened in my home state in Monterey Park, California. A time of a cultural celebration, and yet another community has been torn apart by senseless gun violence.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking Sunday about the mass shooting this weekend at a dance studio in Monterey Park. She will be in Monterey Park this evening to meet with the family members of the victims. 11 people died. All of them were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s and have been identified, and we're going to remember them now. Law enforcement officials say 65-year-old Mei Nan was the first victim of the shootings. She was shot outside the dance hall in her car. She had immigrated from Vietnam in the 1980s. ABC spoke with her niece, Fonda Quan.
She's just a caregiver by nature, and she turned that into a profession as well on the side. And she was just really caring for everyone and anyone. And when I think of her, I hope a takeaway for everyone is just be kind to people. Care for people. You don't know what their backstory is. Sometimes a smile, sometimes, you know, kind words can make their day. And that's how she lived her life.
Shuzhen Yu was 57 years old. Her niece, Kathleen Fong, started a GoFundMe page for their family. And on that page, she shared a photo of her aunt. It was taken 2 days before she died. Fong said that her aunt immigrated from China and that she and her husband had been working hard to support their two daughters' college education and took in a lot of work to make ends meet. Another victim and dance hall regular, Yu Lun Cao, was 72 years old, and he was known in that community as Mr. Nice, according to some of his friends who also started a GoFundMe. They said he welcomed newcomers to the studio with open arms and would gladly offer to teach them basic moves. He loved to dance so much, they wrote, even if it was only him on the dance floor. Cao's dance partner spoke to ABC and said that he shielded her from the bullets.
Just in my heart, I was thinking, I see him all the time. From now on, I cannot see him tomorrow. You see this person just yesterday, and then from now on, you don't see him no more.
And now you don't see him no more. Valentino Marcus Alvaro was 68 when he died. His family said in a statement that he was a loving father, a dedicated son and brother, and a grandfather who loved his granddaughters fiercely. They said he loved ballroom dancing in his community and was the life of the party. His daughter spoke to KTLA.
I like to think that he danced his way into heaven. This place was just a big part of our lives, and I never thought it would take this kind of turn.
Members of the dance studio community are also remembering Ming Wei Ma as the heart of the Star Ballroom Dance Studio. Ma, who was 72 years old, helped manage the studio. He also taught there. A close friend of his told CBS he was the first person in the building to rush the shooter.
He was extremely respected, very beloved, very caring teacher, instructor, extremely kind human being, and that he's very much missed by everybody in the Star Dance community.
Diana Tom's family describe her as a hardworking mother, wife, and grandmother on their GoFundMe page. She was 70 years old. Her family says she loved to dance and that she was someone who always went out of her way to give to others. Wen Tao Yu was 64 years old when he died. His son told the New York Times that Yu went back to school a month ago to become a pharmacist. His son admired him for that, for always striving to better himself. He said his dad's books and notes are still strewn around his desk and that it's heartbreaking. The four other victims in the shooting are 76-year-old Chia Yao, 63-year-old Lillian Lee, 67-year-old Moi Dai-ung, and 62-year-old Hong Ying Jian. As we mentioned earlier, Vice President Harris will be in Monterey Park this evening to grieve with the families of these victims. Coming up, the many legal and financial problems for Google. And one consequence of all that rain we had in California recently, a bunch of flooded cars now on the market. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're only a few weeks into the new year, but so far it has not been a good one for Google. Last week, the company announced it was laying off 12,000 workers. For its parent company, Alphabet, revenue is down roughly 25% compared to this time last year. And now the Justice Department, California, and seven other states are suing Google over its digital advertising business. Here's Attorney General Merrick Garland yesterday.
We alleged that Google has used anti-competitive, exclusionary, and unlawful conduct to eliminate or severely diminish any threat to its dominance over digital advertising technologies.
This is just the latest lawsuit to target Google's power over online advertising. The company faces similar lawsuits from groups of state attorneys general. Here to talk about what all this means for Google's future is Ashley Gold. She covers the tech policy and industry for Axios. Welcome back to Press Play, Ashley.
Thank you.
All right. A lot of lawsuits. It's pretty confusing. But let's just talk about this latest lawsuit. What do they allege?
So the Justice Department is alleging that after Google acquired DoubleClick back in 2007 and then acquired a couple other of ad tech companies in the years following, they built this juggernaut that really could not be defeated by any competitors because they owned all parts of the digital advertising system, the technology which places ads, the system which people make bids to place those ads, and the platforms where they go, such as on your Google search page or on YouTube. So it became that they owned all parts of the digital advertising ecosystem, and they were able to sort of set terms in a way that made it hard for advertisers to switch to other ad tech companies or other platforms. And they also had some stipulations in their deals that sort of kept you in the Google system if you were using any of their ad technology.
Okay, let's go back and explain exactly how it works. Because when you think of Google, you think search engine, and that is one part of their business. But the other part is what we're talking about today is the digital ad system that they have, this technology that they have. And that's when you go on another website and you see powered by Google, right? That's an ad that they get money for. And how big is that in terms of their business, that part of it?
So ads do make up 80% of Google's business, but there's a smaller percentage that makes up this particular part of their ad business that the Justice Department is specifically looking at. The company says that's about 12%, but it's a little unclear exactly how much of the company they're aiming at as far as where the ads are. We'll see in the lawsuit just how much of the company's business is sort of under scrutiny here when the case gets going.
And this is joined by these other states, right? Are they alleging the same thing?
Yes. Yes, they are.
So this is bipartisan, right?
It's bipartisan. Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot that people agree on in DC these days, but this idea that big companies, especially big tech, are too big and too consolidated, that's something that really resonates with both parties.
And is the accusation that if you are an advertiser or a publisher, you have to go through this Google advertising system? Otherwise, you just can't advertise on websites because Google dominates it all?
The accusation is that Google allows you sort of the most access to the most people. It's a good system to use for a lot of sort of visibility. But once you're locked into their system, you don't have a lot of choices but to do sort of what the Google system is telling you to do. And you have to deal with their prices and their terms. It sort of leaves the advertisers with not a lot of power.
Right. So they have to give money to Google. And then also the places where the ads are appearing did they also have to pay Google?
So, yes, you want to be part of the system of Google's ad exchange. So you are one of the places where an ad might show up. It's done in this system that's a little wonky. We don't have to get too into it, but it has to do with real-time bidding. So everyone sort of gets tied up into Google's ecosystem, no matter what, you know, no matter where you fall as an advertiser or as just a company or anyone like that.
So there's nowhere else to go, basically, is what they're alleging.
There are other places to go, but the Justice Department is alleging that Google has used its power and stature and its own rules to put it at a very unfair advantage to its smaller competitors.
And so it wants to spin off that part, that 12% of its business.
Indeed.
So what does Google say about all this?
Google says that this lawsuit fundamentally misunderstands how our ad business works, that there's plenty of competition out there. The other big tech companies are investing heavily in digital advertising too. Amazon, Meta, TikTok. Everyone loves to talk about TikTok and, yeah, you know, the bite they're taking out of digital advertising. They point to Comcast. They point to, you know, major TV networks, and they say, hey, we're not the only player here. And there's plenty of other ad exchange companies out there that are doing well too. But when you look at the numbers, I mean, Google just has the lion's share of all of it. So maybe they do have competitors, but they're not gobbling up nearly as much of the sector as Google is.
Okay. Well, let's look at some other challenges that Google is facing, most specifically from Microsoft, which this week announced that it will be investing billions more into this company called OpenAI. It's an artificial intelligence company that makes ChatGPT. What does this mean for Google?
So what it means for Google is that Microsoft is sort of going to be on the cutting edge of like associating itself with this really popular, buzzy OpenAI thing, the ChatGPT. ChatGPT has really sort of captured like the public imagination when it comes to really getting through to people on what this next wave of generative text AI is. Because it's publicly available and people have been able to use it in real life cases and see what it can do, it's really created a lot of buzz. Microsoft is smart by attaching itself to that buzz, especially because its Bing browser is not particularly popular, especially compared to Chrome. So, I mean, Google has its own AI projects going on that do pretty similar stuff to ChatGPT, but it's not public the way ChatGPT is. It's not something everybody can use. It's like something their researchers are working on that they've, you know, published blog posts about here and there, but it hasn't like broken through to the public in the way OpenAI's products have. So Microsoft is smart to sort of ride that wave.
Right. So it's a different way of searching for things, right? When you use ChatGPT, info comes in real sentences, not in web links.
And Yeah, if you put in a question or a prompt and say, hey, write this in the style of an Axios article, it will, you know, throw something back at you. And oftentimes it's pretty uncanny.
Right. But or let's say, give me some ideas for vacations in Italy. It won't just give you a bunch of web pages. It'll tell you, oh, you should go to Venice at this time of year. And here's where you can rent a hotel room, etc.
Exactly. But it isn't always right. It doesn't do real-time fact-checking, which is, you know, a major weakness. So that's something we need to be looking out for.
Right. But how threatened is Google by this? Are they? I read an article recently saying that management declared this code red, ChatGPT.
I definitely could see why they think it's such a threat. But I guess the cynical part of me still thinks Google Chrome is this very dominant browser. Bing has not caught the public's eye. Microsoft is, you know, associated with the general public for, you know, office things like Word and PowerPoint and LinkedIn. And it's not necessarily this like sexy technology the way Google has been able to present itself. But I definitely understand the threat, but I think any threats to Chrome's dominance are more in the long term. I don't see anything happening immediately.
Okay. And so what was behind this layoff of 12,000 employees, 6% of its workforce?
So I think like every other big tech company, you know, none of them really foresaw just how tight the economy was going to get, how the market was going to stay kind of down They all overhired and were overzealous at a time when the market was better. And my sense is a lot of these cuts probably could have been avoided, but they were sort of shielding themselves for further economic turmoil and sort of cutting before it got really, really bad. I think that's what has happened to all the big tech companies. It's certainly discouraging and dispiriting to hear longtime employees are being laid off, but it shows that they're sort of culling and really doubling down on areas where they think they're actually going to make more money. And I think that's something they need to do as digital ads, which they're so big in, are sort of, you know, lowering for everyone their value. And that market is sort of cratering right now.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So they are focusing on artificial intelligence then, hiring in that department?
Yeah, so AI for sure, and other sort of future technology things, and their cloud section as well.
All right. Ashley Gold, tech policy reporter for Axios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we here in California are still recovering from those heavy storms. The damage is estimated to be around $1 billion. Along with all the homes, businesses, and roads ruined in those storms, the rain also destroyed hundreds, if not thousands, of cars. A lot of them could end up for sale again, and sometimes the damage is not obvious. So buyer beware. Daniel Miller covers business for the Los Angeles Times, where he wrote about this. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we saw those cars on the news just flooded, floating away. What happens to cars that get ruined by storms?
So water damage is some of the worst damage you can do to your car. When water gets inside a vehicle, inside the engine bay, inside the interior, it can cause all sorts of problems. And it ranges from mold to rust to basically destroying the electronics. These days, cars are so complicated that once the electronics are cooked, you're not reviving that vehicle.
So why aren't these cars just melted down and forgotten about?
So there's actually a thriving market for vehicles with flood damage. And this is something that has long been the case. And you may see as an Angeleno, you know, stories about hurricanes on the East Coast leading to droves of flood damaged cars that later get sold at auction. And that's what's going to be happening here. When insurance companies total vehicles because of flood damage, the vehicles are often then unloaded at auctions. And some of these auctions are open to dealers, and some of these auctions are in fact open to the general public. And there are ways that these cars can have a new life. Some are shipped overseas, some are taken apart and sold as parts, and some are even bought by perhaps some unscrupulous operators who want to obscure that flood damage and sell them to another person.
So it's possible to dry out these cars that have just been completely saturated and present them at an auction and they look fairly normal?
That's right. I mean, one of the issues with water damage and why this is such a dangerous issue is that it's often hard to detect the damage unless you're giving a vehicle a close inspection. And I'm told by people who frequent these massive car auctions that you don't always get a chance to really get under the hood and see what's going on with this vehicle, see what the damage may be. You're having to act fast and make a bid on a vehicle that may not even go for that much money. So perhaps it's worth the gamble. But, you know, sometimes these cars are salvageable, sometimes they're not.
What happens if you buy a car that's been flooded? What can you expect?
So it's funny. I spoke to a handful of experts, people who are well aware of the salvage market. And, you know, they said, get on your hands and knees, pull up that carpet. Is it musty? Is it moldy? Does it stink? That's a big red flag.
What is that smell?
So
is that the smell of wet carpet?
It's just the smell of wet carpet, a soggy
wet
vehicle.
Dog.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we all know that smell. It's a smell we don't want to have when we open our car door. And that's the first red flag. You know, you could also have serious structural issues like rust in the floorboards. You do not want to be in a car accident with a vehicle with, you know, these important parts that are just rusted over. So, you know, it runs the gamut. In our rainstorms just from the last couple of weeks, You know, it's possible that a car wound up being fully submerged for 2 days and it's really shot. It could also be that a car was in a parking garage and a leaky pipe got through a seal on the window. And, you know, there's some mold on the interior and that's about it. So you sort of have to know what you're doing if you're going to be buying one of these vehicles.
And does all that have to be disclosed by the seller?
So when a car is totaled, the insurance company will make a report to the DMV and it'll be given a salvage title or even a junk title. And these are basically signs for the consumer that there's a serious issue in this vehicle's past. And if you're to buy it, that you need to do your due diligence. That information is publicly available. Services like Carfax can help people get to some information about a vehicle's past. But at the same time, it can be scant information. And so if you're buying a used car that may have been in a flood, you really have to sort of take it on faith that it's okay, that the dealer says the vehicle's all right, or do a serious inspection.
And does it matter where you buy the car? Are there certain places where you won't get one of these waterlogged cars, or they'll be upfront about it and other places that are a little more sketch?
I mean, look, I think it's fair to say that there are, you know, used car dealers that are honorable and do things the right way. And if they're going to sell a vehicle that had been in a flood and has a salvage title, that they will give you a list of things they've done to improve that vehicle and rectify any issues. I think that is out there. At the other end of the spectrum, there are dealers that might just say, yeah, it's got a salvage title. It's listed as having some water damage, but, you know, drives fine to me. And so it really is a buyer beware type situation. I spoke to a couple people who work in and around this industry, and they basically said their advice was simple. Don't buy a car that's been in a flood.
Yeah.
So there is that little bit of homework you got to do.
So I guess it's more important now because the used car market has been so hot lately. It's been hard to buy any used car.
That's right. So the introduction of, you know, possibly thousands of flood damaged vehicles into our state's used car market is another twist in a stretch that's been really strange for the used car market. So as many people know, during the first couple years of the pandemic, there was a huge shortage of used cars for a variety of reasons. Some of it was supply chain issues in the new car market. The other issue that people often cite is the collapse of the rental car market, which led to fewer rental cars hitting the used car market. And what that has meant is that people have been paying higher and higher prices for used cars. And, you know, maybe for some dealers, an influx of once flooded cars will be a welcome sign, extra inventory in a really tight market.
So can you trust the Carfax when it comes to flood damage history?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, the information on the Carfax is sort of like a starting point. It's sort of like the initial red flag that if the vehicle is listed as having a salvage title or even a junk title, and you know, maybe there's a line of information that relates to why it has that title, you know, something as simple as water damage. That's sort of the beginning of the effort to try to understand what really happened to this vehicle. And for some consumers looking for a deal, maybe that's, you know, a mystery worth solving because these cars are bargains compared to their non-flooded, you know, cousins. At the same time, I'm sure for plenty of consumers, it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah. How much cheaper is a flooded car?
So, you know, there's a wide range, I would say. I think, you know, experts have said you're looking at anything from a 40 to 70% discount on Kelley Blue Book value when it comes to a flood damaged car. And obviously, with the price of cars on the rise, with used cars so expensive, that can be a very enticing discount.
Daniel Miller covers business for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the author of a best-selling self-help book says you don't really need to buy his book.
What I've found is that, like, if you're getting enough sleep, you're spending time around people you love, and you're spending a few hours each day doing something you like that solves 90% of it. You don't need a book to figure that out.
Mark Manson, the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Amid all the drama in the recent Kevin McCarthy speakership fight, California Congresswoman Katie Porter sat coolly reading a book to troll Republicans. The shot of her in a bold orange blouse that matched the color of the book's cover went viral. The book was the 2016 bestseller, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F, a counterintuitive approach to living a good life. In it, writer Mark Manson argues that we should focus our energy on the few things in life that are actually worth caring about and stop giving a you-know-what about the rest. The book has sold more than 10 million copies, and it's now a documentary. Mark Manson is the narrator and the star of the documentary, and he joins me now. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so what was your reaction seeing that photo of Congresswoman Porter?
Oh, just pure amusement.
I'm not sure she was actually reading it. She was just kind of posing because it looked good. But
so apparently she read it a few years ago. She was a fan of the book. And then she wanted to make a statement. And so she brought a copy to the chamber to make said statement. So she's read it in the past. But obviously, that what she did was designed, a PR stunt.
Well, talk a little bit more about the book itself and what the general philosophy is, because on the face of it, it looks like you're telling people not to care about things, but it's the opposite. You're telling people to care about just a few things that really matter.
Yeah, it's ultimately a book about values and prioritization. You know, the F-bombs are kind of a literary trick to get the average person who's walking through an airport and is super stressed out to actually stop and pick up the book. But like, once you get into it, you realize that the book is about, hey, what are your priorities? Like, what are you choosing to put your attention on? What are you putting your energy into? And is that an optimal use of your attention and energy? Because it's, I think in this day and age with social media and smartphones and everything, I think most of us kind of intuitively know that we're not prioritizing our time and attention very well.
Right.
So that's ultimately what the book's about. And, you know, there's all sorts of different side concepts and ideas that tie into that main point. But really, it's a point about, hey, what are you choosing to care about? And is it worth caring about?
Hmm. And I guess for everyone, that would be a different answer. And yet we are all on the internet, we're all in social media, we're all doing this stuff to distract ourselves. And oftentimes, I'll admit it, it's pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're doing it because we like it, right?
Yeah, it feels good. It's fun. It, you know, it takes your mind off problems. And look, there's nothing wrong with that to a certain extent. I think a certain amount of diversion in your life is natural and probably healthy. I think where the problem is when you become so inundated with so much information and so many messages and so many different people saying contradictory things, it becomes very confusing. And I think it's more difficult than ever before to figure out what is worth caring about and what is not. When you live in a world where you have thousands of movies available to you at any moment, thousands of news stories available to you at any moment, hundreds of apps that deliver you information and food and any product you could ever want, where you can contact literally every person you've ever known in your entire life with a few clicks of a button. It's suddenly like all of that abundance, it creates this crisis of not knowing where to spend your finite amount of attention.
Right. So how are we to funnel all that away and and choose the few things that we can focus on, given the fact that, well, we live in the modern world and we do need to be online and we do need to know about a lot of things politically, culturally, and we do have to focus on a lot now.
Yeah, we've had all these technological innovations that have given us access to so much information, so many different voices and perspectives. And ultimately, this is a really great thing. But if we're not careful, if we overconsume, it can cause our minds to become lazy, lethargic, unhealthy, and we have to develop a culture of what I call an attention diet, of making sure our sources of information are high quality, nutrient dense, based on facts and research and studies, and that we're not over consuming as to overwhelm ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'm wondering where you got all this. This philosophy, this idea is not new. You didn't invent it, but how did you come across it in your own life? And how did it obviously changed your life, but what was it that made you realize that this is actually the way to live?
You know, I was a child of thriving middle-class boomer parents in the 90s. Like, everything was about, you know, getting the new car and the swimming pool in the back and always having the newest TV. And, you know, I grew up living that, I guess, kind of vision of the American dream. Mm-hmm. And so I learned at a very early age that doesn't really work.
In terms of happiness?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a very, on paper, it was a very wealthy and successful family, but, you know, everybody was kind of emotionally dysfunctional and miserable inside. So I think I was blessed with the learning experience very early on that, like, that doesn't solve anything. You know, getting the new car and a swimming pool, like, doesn't fix you.
I mean, it's nice, let's be honest.
Hey, I wouldn't complain if I had a swimming pool, but, you know, so in my early 20s, I found Buddhism and the whole philosophy of letting go and sitting with struggle and pain, you know, like, that was pretty revelatory for me. And then later on, when I started doing a lot of research into psychology and understanding how happiness functions and how our emotions function, I realized that a lot of it kind of ties into this ability to sit with the negativity and be comfortable with the negativity.
So give me an example of how that happened in your life.
The simplest example, I guess, is, you know, early on in my career, I started a handful of web businesses, you know, around 2008, 2009. And one of the websites I started was about relationship advice, which was an area that I also needed a lot of help in. And so I started writing articles about relationship advice. And through that process, I realized that I was in no position of authority, that if, unless I just wanted to, like, start flat out lying to people on the internet, I needed to be honest about my own life situation. And obviously that's terrifying, like, going on the internet and writing in lengthy detail all of your romantic failures throughout your young life. But I said, you know what, I bet there's other people out there who can relate to what I've been through. So let me just see what happens. And I was terrified and anxious, and every part of my being told me not to do it, but I did it. And what I learned from that was that we don't really relate to each other's successes. We relate to each other's pain. There's just something about human nature where when we see somebody being very open and honest and vulnerable about how they've suffered, it reminds us that we're not alone in our suffering, and that mm-hmm. that creates a sense of intimacy. And so that was like, it was a very powerful lesson in that of, like, wow, I shouldn't avoid sharing this stuff. In fact, by being willing to share this stuff, I'm not only empowering myself, I'm empowering thousands of other people.
Right. So we're not alone. We're not, we're not losers. We're not, you know, we're just trying to go along.
We're
just trying to get through it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. I guess that's also a refreshing part of your book. You write, you know, no one's special. And a lot of us think we are, or that we should be. and that if we're not, something's wrong with us.
You know, in some sense, we all are unique, but I think it's when you tell yourself that you need to be special, it puts an unreasonable pressure on yourself, because at the end of the day, it's like 99% of what you and I experience, it's stuff that millions of other people experience as well. It's actually a very comforting realization of like, oh, my problems are not special. They're actually very, very common. They're very normal. They're very human. And, you know, the only reason it doesn't feel that way is that we don't really talk about them.
But it can feel like, what's the whole point then? I mean, if you're not striving to be really good at something or to make a difference or to, I don't know, to be special, then what's the point? Like, what are we here for?
Well, I don't think you need to be special to make a difference. You know, I think that sort of thinking is subtly counterproductive, you know, because I think that believing that is actually what keeps a lot of people from trying to make a difference. They're like, oh, well, what can I do? I'm just, you know, Joe Schmo. Mm-hmm. You know, when you realize that it's like, look, you don't need any special qualification to go try to make a difference in the world. You can just go do it and see if it works. Yeah, you know, I think that's a liberating concept.
So what are the things that you do give a F word about?
I try to keep my Fs dedicated to simple and mundane things. I think that's actually probably the healthiest thing to do. You know, so close relationships in my life, friends and family, keep working on my career. And then one thing that I'm trying to give more F's about the last couple of years is my physical health, you know, taking care of my body, sleeping well, eating well. And it's funny because I think a lot of people who come to self-help material, they have this idea that like the solution to their unhappiness or their anxiety or their problems is there's got to be like this big, fancy, complex idea out there that they're just not understanding. And it's what I've found is that like, if you're getting enough sleep, you're spending time around people you love, and you're spending a few hours each day doing something you like that solves 90% of it. You don't need a book to figure that out.
But then how would you make a living?
Yeah, right.
Don't say that. But what about the larger existential problems facing humanity? Shouldn't we be giving an F about that? I mean, we're just being wiped away by these storms, for example. That's a direct result of humanity's messing up the world. And so shouldn't we care about how to fix it?
Look, there are a lot of very, very large problems in the world. I think it's probably most useful if we each kind of pick one to focus most of our energy and attention. I think one of the side effects of kind of the social media age is that we're all so aware of all of the problems all the time that we feel overwhelmed and we feel very helpless. And so I think it's probably more useful for us to each individually kind of be like, okay, I know there's all these huge problems going on in the world, but like, this is the one that I'm going to spend most of my energy and efforts trying to help.
And have you chosen one yourself?
Kind of. I guess, given the nature of my profession, I just consistently find myself in situations and areas that involve mental health and mental well-being. So I try to stay focused on that. I've found that whenever I drift and start worrying about everything that's happening all the time, I become less effective at what I do.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Mark Manson, author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F, A Counterintuitive Approach to Living a Good Life, which is now a documentary film as well, available for digital download on Amazon Prime and Google Play. He's also author of the book Everything is F'd, a book about hope. Again, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the boots is black to match.
riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch. Now, can't nobody feel.
Coming up, how the Western drama Yellowstone has made city slickers want to dress like cowboys. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Yellowstone, Paramount's Western drama about Montana ranchers fighting off developers and native tribes as they build a political dynasty. It is the hottest show on TV right now.
This is war.
War's over, Beth.
No, Jamie. War is just beginning.
They will come after you with both barrels, Governor.
Look forward to it. Nobody knows what the hell we do anymore. It's time we remind them.
You want to know the real price for protecting the ranch? I don't think you do.
Well, this franchise is so popular, it's inspiring city slickers far from the open range to change their fashion to sport Stetsons and sheep-lined flannel, big hats, and dreams of big sky country. Jacob Gallagher is the men's fashion columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where he wrote about this. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So for those of us who haven't seen it, describe the aesthetic of the show.
The show is very kind of modern Western in its way. There's a lot of cowboy boots and cowboy hats that are happening on screen. But of course, then there's also, you know, kind of what I would call nicer apparel in a certain way. You know, I think that a lot of the Dutton family, which is the main family that the show centers around, they are no longer necessarily getting their hands dirty. You know, some of them are suit wearing at this point, but a lot of them are kind of the folks in charge as opposed to the folks kind of wrangling the horses every day.
Oh, nice use of wrangling, by the way.
Yeah. You know, it's I had to, as I was writing this, I had to think through every single kind of horse-related pun I could think of, or every farm-related term that I knew in my repertoire as someone that lives in New York City. But the show kind of does have an upscale ranch look to it, let's say. You know, kind of your nicer leathers and suedes here and there, jeans that are enviably distressed, things of that nature.
I see. Okay. So not necessarily dirty dungarees with holes in them.
No, but to be sure, you know, on some characters, I spoke to some fans of the show and they were calling out, you know, the more esoteric ranch hands on the show, the kind of minor characters in a way. And even the show creator, Taylor Sheridan, he plays, you know, this really rough and tough cowboy who's kind of one of the most, I would say, down home of the cast. And they're style certainly reflects that. You know, they are the dustiest. They have the clothes that look the most worn in. And there is certainly a contingent of viewers that quite likes that. And that is what they're looking for.
Okay, let's hear a clip of tape from the costume designer. Her name is Ruth Carter. She's the costume designer for the first season. She won an Oscar for Black Panther. Here she is in a 2019 panel discussion of costume designers talking about her work on Yellowstone.
You know, they really like to dress well. I mean, we had the old cowboys coming in with, I mean, you could stand their jeans up in the corner. They were so starched. You know, their shirts were pristine. The cowboy boots were well-worn, broken in, but really quality. You know, the quality of the craftsmanship of that whole culture it's really nice.
It is really nice. Don't you agree?
Yeah, she gets at something really kind of interesting there, which is that this cowboy aesthetic is so intrinsically linked to American style. When we think of jeans, you know, Levi's is kind of the oldest American fashion brand. They are certainly the most impactful American fashion brand, I would say. And going back, you know, certainly their products, they were made from miners initially, but then they very quickly were adopted by cowboys. And there's certainly this kind of denim obsessiveness that is really strong in American style. And it does really come from that fusion, if you will, of utility and then also kind of having a lot of pride in what you wear. And of course, today there's jeans obsessives that, as she said, starch their jeans or that, you know, collect the highest end denim out there. But there's also jean obsessives that look for that very classic style, mm-hmm. that kind of faded, you know, it's like when you close your eyes and you think of a pair of nice Levi's jeans, it's faded. It's probably got some nice wear marks around the pockets and around the jeans. And that is really what this show captures, I think. And A lot of people I spoke with, they were kind of noting that they started watching the show during the pandemic, and there's a real sense of escapism to the show itself. And I think it really comes through in those costumes that, you know, they're transportative in a way. You look at them and you're thinking about the kind of open fields and those big farmlands that they really show in the show.
Right, with a modern touch. So here she is talking in that same conversation about a conversation she had with Taylor Sheridan, the showrunner, about kind of modernizing the look.
We had the best conversation. Like, it went for 2 hours, and he was just telling me about how the West is different, how cowboys aren't the same, how it's not some old idea, it's a new idea, how they wear their clothes very hip-hop at times, and they, you know, invoke a lot of modern fashion, which I found hard to believe, but then it made sense.
What does she mean by hip-hop?
I think you probably have to ask her directly. You know, I mean, hats off to Ruth Carter, who's probably our best working costume designer, I would say, and her repertoire is unimpeachable. Perhaps what she's getting at is that on the show, I think that they rewear a lot of the same things, and there is this kind of, again, personal pride that comes through in the clothes. And I think that that's kind of that modernness, that fastidiousness. They're kind of looking for things that show their personality in a way. You know, I think now cowboy style, as it's expressed on the show, and as I've come to understand it, is kind of how it is these days. It's not just one thing. You know, there's certainly many more products out there on the market. When I interviewed some of these hat makers, gosh, the way that cowboys or people that wear Western hats and cowboy hats, I mean, they're looking for the most idiosyncratic, the most distinct thing possible. They are as nerdy and as, you know, specific about what they want out of their hat as sneaker collectors are. It really does kind of have that same application.
Okay, so are you seeing this stuff on the streets of New York? Are you seeing people wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots in New York?
I don't think here in the city the cowboy hat is any stronger than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But in small ways, you know, I was just in the office yesterday, and a colleague of mine was wearing a denim shirt and a belt buckle, and all he wanted to do was talk about this article and how Yellowstone is influencing what he's wearing. I was actually just in Italy for Milan Fashion Week and for a couple trade shows, and I was talking with a rep for a very high-end Italian brand, and he's got a denim shirt on, he's got a pair of jeans on, and he's saying to me, I love this show, and all I want to do is go to the American West and look at this stuff. And I do think that there is, in smaller ways, that influence bleeding over. Cowboy hats are a hard hurdle to climb, I think, ultimately. Yeah. You know, I, as someone that has tried one on, I think a few years ago I wrote an article about trying to buy one and thinking about buying one. It really is quite a lot of look, as we say. But I do commend the people that wear it, you know.
Well, because you don't want to look like you're wearing a costume.
Exactly. And people I interviewed were kind of making the point that, you know, Urban Cowboy had a lot of influence at one point. City Slickers had a lot of influence at one point. And this seems like a similar kind of trend. But even back then, you know, you weren't really seeing people going into JJ Hat Center here in New York City, which is the biggest hat store in the city, and buying these kind of lumbering Stetson hats. I don't think that really does apply. But I think in those smaller ways, certainly I think cowboy boots and things that are a little bit easier to incorporate into a daily wardrobe, those things we're seeing more of.
Like a shiny belt buckle. Why not?
Like a shiny belt buckle, exactly.
Okay. Jacob Gallagher, men's fashion columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know what I want? I would love it if you are wearing any of this Western garb to tweet us a picture of yourself or put it on Instagram. We'd love to see if you too are a city slicker influenced by this kind of fashion. We are at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. Hey, join us again tomorrow for our film reviews. On Thursday, we'll have The Husbands, Dave White, and Alonzo Duralde. Good Food host Evan Kleinman will also be with us tomorrow. She'll give us a recipe for a delicious Italian food treat. That'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.